Okay. Hello. A very warm welcome to all of you to our PwC Europe Transfer Pricing podcast series. We are recording a number of podcasts as we would like to provide a brief wrap-up of our global TP conference, which we held last October. First time completely virtually. And in this kind of first podcast of the series, we also wanted to put an emphasis on financial transactions. And I'm very glad that I have two exceedingly distinguished and experienced colleagues in this area on board, namely Mariana Doja and David Ledur. Hi, Mariana. Hi, David.
Good morning, Lawrence.
Good morning, Lawrence. Thanks for the invitation. It's really nice to be here.
Mariana is actually a transfer pricing partner in Austria and David in Belgium. Both are kind of the financial transaction specialists in their respective countries and within our PwC Europe community, which comprises the countries Belgium, Netherlands, Switzerland, Austria, Turkey, and Germany, and where we can serve our clients with about 300 dedicated professionals. Now, coming back to our global conference, which is an annual event, which we typically hold in one major city around the globe. We have been in Tokyo, Washington, and wanted to meet in Berlin last year, which obviously could not happen. So we did it the first time virtual. And actually, it was, I would almost say, surprisingly a terrific success. You know, we could cover all the regions, 24 plus time zones. We had 120 live stream workshops and about 10 live stream plenaries, which could be seen, as I said, throughout all regions. And Mariana, if you look back, I mean, this was kind of a unique experience. If you look back to the global conference, what's your, if it's possible to say, one major topic, you know, which you also took away from the conference?
Yeah, hi. Thanks a lot, Lawrence, and also thanks a lot for the warm introduction. I guess both David and I led one of the sessions, and it was a very interesting experience, and also it was nice now preparing for this podcast to think back a little bit to the conference in October. So the global conferences normally are PwC's flagship transfer pricing event. And as you said, it was the first time that we had it virtually. And for me, one big thing was always that I would never have thought that such a big event can work so well in a virtual setting. So we actually reached a lot more people than it would have been possible in a physical conference, which is of course not to say that we are not looking forward to the next one, which will hopefully be physical again, because of course there is a lot of networking aspects that we miss in a virtual setting. But I think the conference went really, really well, and we reached many clients. So I was very happy about that. I think I would like to probably mention two aspects. One is that prior to the conference, or the last, let's say, year or two, there have been a lot of developments in transfer pricing, very exciting technical developments. Obviously, the financial transactions paper came out in February last year, so that's one of the topics we'll talk about, but also the Pillar 1 and 2 and all the developments since the BEPS project. But when we were talking to our clients, one thing that came across to me is that many of our clients are focusing on let's say that the practical and pragmatic aspect. So the issues that may be, let's say, somewhat less exciting from a technical perspective, but what is really impacting our clients' lives. So compliance issues, documentation, things that they meet in audit. And the other point I think that I would like to make, thinking back to the conference, is the impression that since BEP, so since 2015, seems very, very long ago, we have seen a proliferation of transfer pricing rules. Right, regulation on risks, the redrafting of chapters 1 to 3, then intangibles, profit split, lately financial transactions, and so on. So in terms of pages, there has been a lot of development and a lot of more what's probably one was hoping a lot more clarity, but I certainly sensed a sense of frustration coming from our clients during the conference that they feel that with all these new rules, there is not necessarily a lot more clarity about what will be accepted in tax audits, and just confirmation that, okay, if I do something one particular way, then it will be fine. So I think these are probably two themes that I remembered now when thinking back to the conference.
Yeah, thanks, Mariana. That's actually an interesting observation. I mean, you would, on the one hand, expect that more rules kind of provide and more details provide more clarity also when you are actually looking at fact pattern. But I also observed that almost the opposite is true, which is unfortunately and I think that's also a very valid point, as you say, that clients and we are looking for kind of practical, the practical handling in our concrete cases and guidance on the bread and butter issues. David, you hosted one of the sessions on financial transactions. As I said, you are a specialist in this area. Which issues did you concentrate on?
Yeah, thanks, Lawrence. But when we started the conference, we did a sounding, a polling question on what are the items that the clients thinks they will be impacted most of when looking at Chapter 10. And there were two items that clearly stood out. The first one is a whole discussion on the credit risk, so the rating discussion, so how to determine a standalone credit rating and implicit guarantee. And this was a bit surprising to me, but not fully. No, it was surprising to me because to a large extent, what OECD has put in its Chapter 10 is, I would say, broadly in line with what a lot of groups have already been doing for quite a number of years. So on the principles, it's not a complete deviation of existing practices. Now, I think that goes for all countries. Now, there's one country that seems to have a bit deviating approach on that, and that these are the German tax authorities that seem to focus more on tracking external funding, so deviating a bit more or deviating a bit from this credit risk assessment that's in the OECD. Now, I expect that a lot of clients put credit risk high on the agenda because there are still a lot of questions on how to actually apply it. OECD obviously give general principles, but when you apply it and you have to go into the detail, that's when a lot of questions pop up, whether to see it actually makes sense for a given group and a given subsidiary. So that was the first item that was put high in this polling question. The second item was linked to the more general concept of actual delineation of the transaction, the options realistically available, the actual contact of the party. So all concepts that are more linked to substance, to business drivers, to what's called control over risk. So where you have to analyze the specific situation of a subsidiary to see how you structure the funding. So it's not about about benchmarking interest rates. It's about structuring the funding and defending that all the terms and conditions are defendable and in line with how a third party would have done it. Now, here there are quite some questions. How far should you go? If you look to third party funding contracts, often they're more than 100 pages. I don't think that tax authorities expect that intercompany contracts are that complex. But on the other hand, kind of a half a page intercompany contract might not be sufficient neither. So that's a different balance that we'll have to find, and it's about determining and justifying all the terms and conditions, like the maturity, whether there's subordination, whether you use fixed or floating rates, if there are prepayment options, what are the drivers, what is the impact on the pricing, and so forth. And linked to that is, yeah, how many funding sources should a subsidiary have? If you look to the open markets, groups often have multiple sources. They want to have a variation of external funding sources with different characteristics. But it's difficult to expect that a subsidiary has this bunch of intercompany transactions. So is it sufficient to have kind of a short-term type of transaction, like a cash pool, and a long-term, or should you consider to have even more transactions? Now, all these concepts, they're not completely new. It's basically what's already developed in chapter one after the BEPS project, but they're much more specific and much more tailored to financial transactions. And we see that in practice, tax authorities today during tax audit, they refer to this chapter 10.
Which is interesting that they are, quote, already, unquote, referring to that. But you refer to tax audits, and I know it's a difficult question as you oversee so many jurisdictions. But what are the current hot topics in financial transactions you see in tax audits?
Yeah, the thing is, if there's one thing that stands out, that's the cash pool recharacterization. So the discussion whether a cash pool transaction should be a cash pool transaction short term, or whether it should be requalified in a long term transaction. And this seems to be the flavor of the day in many, many countries. For tax authorities, it's quite easy. They come in, they look to the cash pool position of the last 2-3 years. They draw some nice graphs, and they see there's some structural positions. And my observation is they quite mechanically restructure that in the long term loan. Now, that's not always easy to anticipate that for taxpayers, because there might be a lot of reasons why you want to keep it liquid in the cash pool and not put it in a long-term loan. But tax authorities, they tend to ignore that. So here are some best practices that is from time to time, we have to review your cash pool positions, I would say on the yearly basis, and then or adjust it into a long-term loan, or if there are good reasons not to adjust them, that you have good documentation made at that point while you intentionally keep those positions into the cash flow, so you can also use that during tax audits.
Mm-hmm. David, thank you very much. I mean, originally we were planning to have kind of two topics in this podcast. One, the global review of the global conference and financial transactions. And we are already in the middle of part two, the financial transactions. And as I said, we have the experts here. So let's focus a bit even more on this topic. David, you talked, and Mariana, you both talked about chapter 10, but we also have the OECD paper on COVID, which obviously is another hot topic. Is this kind of second paper applicable to financial transactions? Can you draw any conclusions out of that for your practical work?
Yeah. So the document on COVID does not focus obviously on financial transactions, but there are some items that are also applicable for them. Now, as a matter of principle, OECD indicated that the transfer pricing guidelines, they continue to apply as they are also in the COVID situation. So you should continue to apply the arm's length principle. But how you actually apply it should take into account the very specific circumstances that many industries have today. Now, OECD focuses a lot on various transactions where they see that there's a time lag between when market information will become available, so within 1 or 2 years, and how pricing might be adjusted nowadays for COVID. So you have for a lot of transactions this time lag, which is annoying. Now, for financial transactions, they indicate that this should not be a problem because there is real-time information. They do not go in a lot of detail, but they basically refer to quoted bonds, and you can effectively on a day-to-day basis see what is the market yields for a given rating and a given maturity. So they seem to indicate that for the pricing aspect, at least for financial transactions, this should not be too complex. Now, one item they do not cover is the potential impact of the purchase programs of the ECB and other central banks, also referred as quantitative easing. No, what is that? Central banks, they buy certain asset classes, certain types of bonds, which makes that market interest rates go down. And of course, if you are investing in these qualifying assets, market interest rates go down. So also arm's length interest rates go down. Now, it also has an indirect impact on non-qualifying assets, because if interest rates go down on qualifying assets, more people will then look for high returns and invest in more risky assets, for example. So there should be a general trend on market interest rates. But it's today unclear to what extent you have that impact. And you may have a discussion whether you should make some adjustments or not for these purchase programs. And if so, how to do it. Now, nobody, I think, today can make a model to quantify the impact on such programs to apply a kind of adjusted cap. So here, what I think is missing in the COVID document is some more confirmation that you can continue to use this real-time information on the bond market for your pricing, because it's not perfect, it seems most comparable and at least very up-to-date. But I would have appreciated if the OECD would have been a bit more explicit on this.
David, a follow-up question exactly relating to this area. In addition to the impact on interest rate benchmarking, do you feel there are other topics the OECD should have addressed?
Yeah, I think they're pretty complete in saying that you should take into account very specific situations of certain industries that has an impact on the pricing. And I do sympathize with the OECD that they cannot give general guidance, because industries are impacted in very different ways. Some industries even have a positive impact of COVID. Others are highly negatively impacted. So I do concur with OECD that it will be very important that groups document now how COVID is impacted their business, their transfer pricing, and also their financial transactions, how they structure it, and that they have robust documentation now to justify that. So why certain debt capacity levels go up, why they may have to structure their transactions differently, maybe shorter maturities in certain cases, additional liquidity lines in certain cases. This is all very COVID specific, but it's important that you make that documentation today and not when tax authorities ask for it. Maybe, Lawrence, if you allow, a second item is the debt capacity. And that's for me a real challenge, because OECD expects more and more that you also make an arm's length testing of your debt capacity, that you can demonstrate that as an independent entity, you could or would have obtained that amount of debt. And you typically use some financial ratios for that. So for many industries, the financial ratios are heavily impacted by COVID. Cash flows go down, profitability goes down. But there's not yet a lot of market information on how this impacts third parties. So there's some anecdotal information, but to benchmark this is much more difficult. So the question is, can you use information pre-COVID? Likely not. Can you simply ignore the effects of COVID and rework your financials as if COVID would not have taken place? And you basically assume that within a year or so, business would be back to normal? Or would you make some adjustments that would have a long-lasting impact? I don't think there's a single answer, because various industries will be impacted in different ways. But here, some more explicit guidance from the OECD would have been very useful.
Okay, thank you very much, David. Coming back to Mariana and coming also back to chapter 10, Mariana, maybe two questions. One is, to what extent do you expect the guidance to be applicable to existing arrangements? Yeah, do we have, and we touched on that already, do we have a kind of retroactive effect? But maybe before, how did countries react to Chapter 10?
Yeah, thanks, Lawrence. I think that's a very, very important question that was also on the minds of many of our clients because as David mentioned, many tax authorities kind of applied the principles that are now elaborated on in Chapter 10, but of course there are many nuances and there is just a lot more. Wording, for example, on tax authorities on this whole delineation topic, right? And tax authorities implicit authority then to reclassify transactions or requalify transactions that wasn't so explicitly there before. I think that there are many countries, as David mentioned, that. Where there are some differences in let's say emphasis, which is for example Germany. On the other hand, I think everybody was looking for this OECD paper for a very, very long time, right? So historically, this paper has been in the making for years, and there were many drafts out there, and tax authorities started applying the principles even before the paper was published. So you have this mixture of maybe some elements which are applied in practice differently, and I suppose there will be tax authorities that say that okay, the guidance only applies for the future in its entirety. On the other hand, you have a set of other countries, and Austria is one of those. In Austria, we had the new draft transfer pricing guidelines was published beginning of December 2020, and there is very explicit reference there to the essentially retrospective application of the guidance, because they are saying that they are taking a dynamic interpretation of the OECD's guidance. So essentially they are saying that the new guidance is a clarification of the arm's length principle, and therefore it's applicable in its entirety. But of course, if you're looking at the, for example, the Austrian draft transfer pricing guidelines, you see that they copy pasted many parts of Chapter 10, but then went further in some aspects. So, for example, and this is just interesting in the context of the COVID discussion, in the OECD in Chapter 10, there is a section in the context of delineation speaking about the aspects that have to be taken into account when considering if a financing is debt or equity. And they list a number of issues, for example, whether the contract has repayment schedule and is it clear, how the frequency of interest payments and so on. And the parallel in the Austrian guidelines essentially is a list of things that point to a financing being equity. So not issues to be considered, but clear pointers to equity. And one of these items is the company being in a bad economic situation. And I'm just wondering if this statement will find its way to the final version, because now coming out of COVID, I suppose many companies will be in a bad economic situation and will be able to still demonstrate that they would be able to obtain financing on the market.
Thanks, Mariana, for this example, which obviously displays how further complexity comes into the rules if now kind of, and that's what's happening, individual countries start to issue their own guidelines on financial transactions. And that kind of kind of to conclude the podcast, maybe going back to down to earth recommendations after you mentioned kind of the complexities and the unclarity of at least current unclarity, how to interpret some of the rules, the difficulty in general to apply the guidance. What, Mariana, are your recommendations, very practical recommendations to the audience?
Well, I think this unclarity is unfortunately clearly the case, in particular with financial transactions, with the current situation. I mean, we all understand the OECD, that it cannot be very prescriptive. On the other hand, I think everybody knows that there will be differences in interpretation, as you said. Lawrence, I mean, there is not only no explicit guidance on COVID, but for example, what about negative interest rates? Tax authorities still look at this topic in the context of cash pool, which David mentioned before, quite differently. Another thing is that when companies prepare for tax audits, we have to know that the tax authorities will apply the benefit of hindsight, to some extent at least, in terms of also the application of Chapter 10, because current actions will be looked at in a few years' time on audit. And against all this background, I would just like to reiterate really the point that David made earlier, and that is about documentation. And I think it's not only the practitioner speaking kind of here, but also really this is a practical point, because one needs to, if we want to avoid as much as possible that tax authorities take an interpretation which is unfavorable with exactly this benefit of hindsight, it is just important to be able to demonstrate what was the thought process and what were the available evidence that based on which one could make a decision about a particular financing transaction and so on, to essentially limit not only the pricing discussion to which it always ultimately comes down, but also more importantly a fundamental discussion about the characterization of transactions. So I think documentation, and not only in the sense of writing, getting a report done on it, but also the evidence of both parties, along the lines of options realistically available, considering what their options are and why they are going for the particular structuring of the intercompany financing, is currently more important than ever.
Wonderful. Very good concluding sentence, Mariana. Thank you very much. Also to you, David. I think we had an excellent walkthrough, kind of obviously in a very condensed time frame, but an excellent walkthrough the current situation on financial transactions. Before we stop, let me give you two hints to the audience. One, I mentioned that this was part of a series of podcasts. We have two more, one on virtual organizations and BEPS 2.0, and the other one on TP automation and audit readiness. So if you're interested, please also listen in to one of or two of those. The other item I want to mention, we framed it to our TP Global Conference 2020. As Mariana and I think I said, it's an annual event. Our next conference is scheduled for October 13 and 14 this year to take place in Berlin, Germany. That at least is the current plan. Obviously, nobody knows currently whether we can have a virtual, whether we can have a physical conference at that size in this fall. But otherwise, it will be virtual. So please mark your calendar October 13 and 14th and ask your local PwC contact for details and for an individual invitation. And with that, thank you very much for your interest and your attention, Thanks to the audience. Stay safe.